Hola, hello, hi, bienvenido, and welcome back or welcome to Mentors Today. Today I'm super excited to basically just be talking to a friend across LA, which is kind of cool. So super excited to be joined by Natasha Chandel. She is so many things. She is a producer, writer, content executive, dating podcaster extraordinaire, stand-up comedian. She's a seasoned producer and creative with a career spanning MTV, Fox, Disney, and a growing list of other media production companies and video game companies. She constantly juggles her role as a full-time writer, actress, stand-up comedian, voiceover actor, podcaster, and frankly, in my opinion, does it as well or better than any multi-hyphenated millennial that I've ever met. She's a passionate advocate for South Asian representation in the entertainment industry. She's the vice chair of the South Asian Writers Committee within the Writers Guild of America, which probably before people would have heard this podcast, they never would have known what the Writers Guild of America was, except for the summer that we have lived through here in Los Angeles. She's dedicated through that work to really enhancing the visibility and employment opportunities for South Asian WBA members, and frankly, just South Asian creatives in general. You were born in Dubai, but her journey has taken her through Mumbai, Toronto, New York, and now to her life here in Los Angeles. She, in my humble opinion, is a creative force of nature. She's got an infectious energy, which you will all enjoy now. And she's really not just working to build a career for herself, but she truly is working to have her work set an example for other people and leave a legacy for people that look and or sound and or come from the same places that she did, because there just aren't enough of them, her, in the entertainment world. So welcome to Mentors Today, buddy.
Oh my gosh, that was such a nice intro. I feel like really good about myself. Who is that person?
That's the goal. I'm going for two things every show. Can I make you feel really good about yourself in the intro? And then at some point before the end of the show, is there a moment when I have an opportunity to maybe make you shed a tear?
Oh, like man, it's not going to be that hard for me. I cry all the time. It's kind of silly.
How are you?
No, thank you so much. I'm good. Feeling great, you know, after a post-strike. I do want to clarify one thing, even though I know we're going to talk about it later, but I don't want to get in trouble. So I'm the vice chair of the South Asian Writers Committee. It's of WGA Writers, but it is not an official WGA committee. So we just want to always say that because we don't want to get in trouble.
Important to know.
Yeah.
And the work still stands in the community.
Yeah. But otherwise I'm feeling really great. For listeners who don't know or don't know when this is going to be, this is, you know, September 27th, and at 12:01 today, the Writers Guild strike officially ended, and we are allowed to write again, which just, you know, after 4.5 months, almost 5 months, feels like a relief, and it feels amazing. We could just do this out in the open again. Like, real time, I don't think anything's going to change for like 80% of people right away.
Yeah,
like,
no.
If you had a show or something's in development, great. Like, you're working again. The rest of us, we have the possibility of work, but possibility is so wonderful, right? Like, potential makes us feel great.
Yes, 100%. And on all that, and basically we are, as we talked about right before the show, we're going to kind of reframe this. So the whole point of this conversation, or the instigation for us getting together and hanging out this way, as opposed to other ways that we might hang out, was that we wanted to talk about this intersection between the world of entrepreneurship that I play in and the world of entertainment that you play in or that my daughter plays in, because it was the root of kind of how we got to know each other online and then how, like, a lot of what we talked about the first time we ever hung out for lunch. And just like, I was fascinated to learn more intricacies of the life that you live. And then you were kind of like, because you're on this binge to try and learn more about business to empower your career, you're like, I'm fascinated by how similar the things that I was talking about sounded to the things that you experienced. So we're going to talk about that. That's the big theme today. But like you said, let's be really relevant. And I was talking about it with my daughter yesterday because my niece, who wrote a paper at school for her seminar on current events class or AP class that she's taking here in Orange County, she chose the writer strike as her topic.
Oh, wow.
Because she was like, she loves Riley and she loves anything. She wants to be a writer someday, she thinks, at 15. And so she chose to write about it. And so then, of course, Uncle Rob started feeding her like, well, go check out this podcast. Go listen to this. Go read this link. Go read the negotiating points, right? And so she texted me yesterday. She's like, so does this mean Riley gets to go back to work? And I said, my daughter won't care that I'm saying this on the podcast. I was like, well, actually, let's not forget the show that Riley was working on, which ended in March, which ended, like that show was ending, right? She had already made the decision in her career arc to leave that show and go like pursue new opportunities, new relationships, new shows. And I was like, so actually Riley just kind of goes back to being unemployed now.
And that's a lot of writers. And like, if you see Twitter, there's a good chunk of people who are like, cool, cool, cool. Now I just go back to being regularly unemployed.
Right. Yeah. Fun employed for like those fun employed with a purpose for like 6 months.
Yeah. But you know, you like to feel like you can keep moving. You want to be able to put one foot in front of the other, especially when so much of writing is, there's two parts, right? There's the idea of like being staffed on a show and then there's the selling of shows, which is what most writers do, selling of shows or movies. And for that process, it anyways takes so long. And so then when you're paused and you're on a strike, you can't do anything. That takes a lot out of you, you know, because you're motivated because of the fact that you're moving towards your goal. And now suddenly you can't.
Right. Exactly.
Yes. But I get it. It's like for many of us, my show ended the show I was on in February of this year. And so I was like, cool.
Right. Yeah. You were like a month before her. Exactly. Yeah. So you were both going to be like out in the market, like selling your ideas, trying to get staffed on a new show, you doing 27 other things in between. But yeah. And then the strike was kind of like, we're supposed to now go do this for mm-hmm. hopefully for not long, but then it turned into for most of the year.
Yeah. It turned into most of the year, which is kind of what I predicted. I was saying around October is when I thought that it would end, but we did win historic gains. I mean, just an exceptional deal. I think most writers, 8%, there's always some people who aren't happy, but I think 98% of writers would say like, wow. I think everybody was just shocked. There were things in there that people have been fighting for years for, years and years and years before this strike, before many strikes, you know? And like for the first time, staff writers are getting a script fee. You know,
so many things in there.
So many.
We were talking. I had to go back and I'm sure you had the same tweets that you saw because we followed a lot of the same people. And so I had found right before she sent it to me, I had found one of those posts that basically took the original May, you know, negotiating points and responses or non-responses, and then where the agreement wound up. And I was just the business junkie in me was just like, okay, I don't care about the summary, and I don't care about Matt Bologna's opinion on the Town podcast, but like, I don't care. Like, these are all just speculative. Like, let me look at what the deal was, what their response was, and then what did we agree to? And I said to someone this morning, it felt like there were like three anchor pieces of it to me. Like, one, it felt like they built in just a lot of structural, like institutional protections of the roles, like of the job titles, right? Two, obviously you got some financial uptick, like, which is always going to happen in any labor negotiation eventually, right? And then three, at the least, it seems like you guys put like initial guardrail, malleable maybe that it might be, around AI to kind of say like, let's at least all agree we're going to stick it in this box over here. And then we're going to also agree that we're going to have to all figure it out. So that's how it felt to me, like kind of those three buckets.
Yeah, totally. I think the financial gain is huge. I really appreciate that they put some boundaries and an area for studios to work within in terms of like minimum staffing and how long people are employed. There's a minimum of how long people have to be employed. I'm assuming it means that, you know, a studio would have to pay even if you don't use them, but you might as well use them.
That was kind of how I read it. It was kind of like, you might not get utilized, but you are minimally contracted for these periods so that you can have predictability of income, right?
Yeah, because it's crazy, you know, like it's getting to a point where people are getting hired for 4 weeks, for 8 weeks to make an entire show in 8 weeks. And then they're not getting hired back when the show is going into production. So this is ensuring that those people are getting onto those shows, and that there's a minimum amount of weeks that people get to work, which, for stability, for a career, I just felt like when I read it back, I was like, oh, this actually motivates me to pursue my career again. Because there was a point you're like, why are we doing this? Like, this is crazy. This is a stupid career choice. I was like, oh, my Indian parents were right. I was like, I shouldn't have done something else.
And you've also, you are successfully doing variations of this, like other things in the entertainment industry, and successfully, I'd say, right? And so.
Yeah, but you know,
That would be a natural thought process. Like,
of course, a lot of people ask you that, or you know, people go like, "Oh, you do so many things," and I'm also like, "You had to, like, I have to." It's a gig economy in a sense, right? If one of these things could pay me forever, I would love to just do one thing.
And you are at your heart, at your core, you're a writer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, you might be a great stand-up comedian, and yes, you're a voiceover actress, and yes, you can produce other people's things. But in your heart of hearts, like, you're a writer who has a point of view, who has stories inside of her that she wants to tell, or can synthesize other people's stories in very unique, very compelling ways. And that's your gift. That's your skill. That's the thing you've worked really hard on for your adult life. And so you want to manifest it. You want to be that. You want to be the showrunner who produces the stories that, just like my daughter does someday. Like, you guys are that. You're that type of strong woman. Let's go back, because we're in the weeds now. Some people are being like, what are they talking about? Right? Which is, that's cool. That's how we learn. But let's take this all the way back up to the top, because here's a question someone might ask, right? So wait a minute. You just said gig worker. You just said, like, freelance. You just basically said that the scope of the industry or the job was like that you're unemployed a lot and you're working on these different deals and the timeframes are different and the compensation's different. But then you were just out on like a strike line. Like, aren't you guys like the auto workers? Like, aren't you just employed by these big studios and you just have careers and you were striking to get your career back? Or are you all basically little entrepreneurs?
Oh, we are all little entrepreneurs for sure. I mean, it took me a long time, and I think it takes most artists a long time to wrap your head around that. But, you know, it's called show business. And I think we forget the business part and we all focus on the show part, but it's a business and we are the product. And so we're a brand and we're constantly selling ourselves when we do pitches, when we do meetings, even when you're trying to get staffed on a show, you are trying to prove your value in this big machine. And, you know, so many things, I think regular people just don't get how much it is in like a regular job, in the sense that you're going for interviews, we have resumes, we're constantly pitching our value. And
but when you do, like, even when you with the resume and the job and the interview and you, okay, I got the job, that's not a job in the traditional sense of like, and this was me and you when we first met. And I was like, I've been a consumer of entertainment media my entire life. And I, old guy that I am, was even like, I mean, I thought Riley, when she got her first like assistant job, I'm like, I thought you just, now you work for the studio for life. Like, and she's like, well, no, Dad, I'm attached to the show. And the show is like 40% owned by this studio. And then like 50% owned by the guys who run the show. And I'm like, yeah, but don't the guys who run the show, like, aren't they employees of the big studio? She's like, no, they basically have their own production. And I was like overwhelmed by all that. I was like, so wait a minute, you guys, this isn't a career at all. You're all entrepreneurs. The guys that run the shows are entrepreneurs. The studios or the streamers or the producers, they're just the investors. So again, when you're out there on a strike, this was different than what's going on with the auto workers, where those people are literal employees who have like walked off their 9-to-5 salaried with benefits, like I work here for 32 years types of jobs, and they go out and they pick it. You guys are like a bunch of independent contractors who've gotten together to pick it against a whole industry, not necessarily just your employers. That's fascinating to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, you, and I think you put it even better than I could put it, but that's exactly what it is. We're all independent contractors. We all work freelance. Our jobs can range from a week, 4 weeks to 9 months. When a show goes on hiatus, we stop working. And yeah, we're not employees. So when I wrote on a Netflix show, my parents thought like, oh, so she works for Netflix. And I said, no, I don't work for Netflix. I work on a Netflix show. I am technically under a production company that's under my showrunner. And yeah, you're an independent contractor that way. And there's so many layers to our industry, like contract negotiations for each of us is like a separate business entity contract. Yeah. A lot of us also have our own businesses. You know, when you get to a certain level, writers, LLC, or they
I was going to say, is that like, have you structured, because again, you have multiple interests.
I haven't actually.
But you would eventually.
I will eventually, for sure. Yeah. I haven't. I've thought about it a lot.
Thinking more about it lately, apparently, from what you've said.
I know. It's exactly. And then, or, you know, some people incorporate and all of that. So we are definitely mini businesses. But a lot of artists don't see that. They definitely don't think that way. And for a multi-hyphenate, it's even slightly more nuanced. Like, you now have to think of branding, you know, which is very different.
Which, again, literally now every entrepreneur who listens to this show, which is the like entrepreneurs, investors, executives are the predominant part of our audience. Now they're all like, oh, I get it. Okay. So she's got to do all the same things we do. You curate how you utilize social media. You have Natasha, the stand-up comedian, but then now that we're back in the writing game, like there's another part of you that will be exposed to other things you do. You, the voiceover actress or actor, sorry.
Yeah. And look, as an actor, there's few things I control, but even there you have kind of a brand and people, you know, that's why a lot of people get typecast as a certain thing. And as a writer and especially like a stand-up, you're always selling a brand of who you are. And that part people miss a lot, like the marketing aspect of the business.
So you mean it's not just like, hi, pretty face.
No.
Hi, like, here's my photo. Because that's what we see in TV, right? In movies, is like that a line of people that look the same with the photo, and then the decision is just the photo. You're like, no, there's more to that story.
Oh, no. I mean, I wish actors just got it based off of a photo and seeing us in person. Like, that would be wonderful. No, it's you have to act. They have to feel like you have an essence of whatever that character is. But again, like, if you see my content, I'm very specific of what I do. So I know a lot of my stuff can be smart, but it can also be kind of goofy. And then I also know that some of it people perceive as a little sexy. And so it's like people know that about me. And so now if there's like a role, they might consider me because they kind of like get that is okay. What she does. As a writer, it's the same thing. When we write samples, people don't realize they're watching our tone. You know, the biggest showrunners, they stand out because they have a brand. Tina Fey has like a cadence to her comedy. Mindy Kaling has like a very fast boom, 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 boom. Aaron Sorkin,
Just going to say, by the way, for some reason during the last like 2 months, I've been binging West Wing again from the beginning. So I've got Aaron Sorkin talk pace in my head permanently
Yeah,
now.
And like White Lotus, great example of one now, right? Like people, they know those people when they are talking, when they hear just the way a flow is. And so when you are writing a sample, they also look for things like that. Like, what is this person's voice? What is their pacing, especially in the comedy world? And then that has to match the pacing, again, for multi-hyphenate, that you do in stand-up, that has to match the things that I do in the content I create. It has to match the stuff I do in the podcast.
Because if it didn't, it would be like bad branding in any business or product would be. It would be like, wait a minute, why? Whoa, I thought yeah. Her product was this. And now over here, I don't like this.
Yeah, exactly that. Like in my podcast, I'm very sex positive and sex forward, right? It'd be weird if in my samples,
you were like a conservative Puritan from Nebraska.
Yeah, exactly. Or I never talked about it, or I never showed it or whatever.
Right.
Same thing with my stand-up. So it all kind of has to like tie in to who you are. So I think with multi-hyphenates, it is a little bit more nuanced of all of it has to track across the board.
I've been curious about this, frankly, for like the last year or so in your life. Has the emphasis or the extra work in these other areas, and so stand-up is just one of the more prominent ones, has that helped you to kind of refine that this is who I am? Like, this is my authentic cadence or story?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'm not as thoughtful as people think in that. What I mean is that like when I start something new, I don't always start it truly knowing where I want it to go.
I gotcha. Okay. So let's reframe that. She's very thoughtful. She's not necessarily as intentional about the strategic choices that she's making when she makes them.
Yes. But you know, it's funnier to say what I But like, yeah, that's exactly it. Like when I started stand-up, it was like, oh, I've loved stand-up since I was a kid. I wanted to do stand-up since I was like 7, 8 years old. But you know, Indian girl from a small city in Toronto, immigrant parents, I wasn't allowed to go out. I wasn't allowed to like do stuff at night. So that wasn't an option to like go out the way people did. During university, I was working a lot and then I was teaching dance. So like a lot of my nights were gone. And then on top of that, I was sick. And then finally went, I used to have Lyme disease, guys, but I'm okay now.
It's okay.
And then when, you know, then when I finally was like, oh, I'm a grown adult, I moved to New York and I could do it. I worked night jobs. So I was a producer at MTV News at night. So I was working from 2 p.m. to 2 a.m. every night for 4 years.
As you said before we got on the show, you've basically been in this speed since you were 15.
Yeah, yeah. And so there was always a good reason why I couldn't do it. And so really for me, it was an outlet to show my voice in a different way, because I just always felt like people see me in a certain way and I wanted to be able to tell the stories I wanted to tell. As a result of that, I have gotten jobs. As a result of that, my writing has become better. My writing helps my stand-up. My stand-up helps my writing. When I go and I do shows, I actually got a job last year on an MTV show because I showcased for Netflix for 5 minutes.
Right.
And
wow.
They just said, oh, she really stands out as like the best writer. And I've gotten that multiple times when I go for stand-up, is like I've gotten feedback from big comedy bookers and, you know, like Laugh Factory guys. And they're like, oh, she's a strong writer. And so that's opened up writing opportunities for me. And then writing opportunities get opened up because you're a stand-up. So I didn't know that, like, oh, they love it when you're a stand-up comedian. And so now it's like an actual cool thing for my writing resume, is that, oh, she's also a stand-up.
That's the I didn't know that. I wasn't thoughtful, right?
Like, exactly. And then I, you know, and then the universe plays some luck and part in all of it. Like when I got staffed on Mr. Iglesias, of course I knew Gabriel Iglesias or Fluffy. I didn't think what role that would play in my stand-up, but he's one of the biggest comedians in the world. So tell anybody you wrote on Fluffy show on Netflix, and immediately people are like, oh, damn. Okay, cool. Right.
You must be a good writer. You must be funny. You must have a sensibility of current time. Yeah, wow.
So all those things like somehow work together. But when I started it, I was very like, I just want to do this thing. And it's the same with my podcast. It's the same with my web series. I think I see some potential, but I don't know what will happen. I just kind of go with the flow of like what's calling to me at that time.
Lean more into the creativity. And now again, as your career has matured, as you've evolved, as we would say on the entrepreneurship side, like as you've evolved as a multi-time founder, right? Like I'm a little bit more seasoned. Okay, now I can be both creative, as my dad used to say, the art and the science, right? So you put in the work, you put in the hours. I'm always convinced my dad said this before Malcolm Gladwell ever came up with these ideas. But like you put in the work, and then that allows your artistic side, your true creativity to come out. Right. And you're very good at doing that. So quick question. So what you're telling me is you weren't typecast as Mumbai Chopra?
I don't know if I've been typecast. I wish I were typecast as Mumbai Chopra, but I wasn't.
Mumbai Chopra is a show we all want to see on Netflix.
I am actually now developing it into a half hour. So it took me a long time to figure out what that would be for this time. And I think I've cracked it.
I think that was the first thing I went and found after we like met each other and started chatting on Twitter, right? It was like, that was the, for whatever reason, that was the thing I found. And I was like, oh my God, she is fucking hilarious.
Oh, thank you.
And also that character, just the character was absurd, like, but also like kind of not absurd.
Well, that's the thing. It's, you know, I'm very proud of Mumbai Chopra. It's a web series I created in 2010 before people had web series. Literally, like, I used to tell people I had a web series and they were like, what's that? And I'd be like, it's on YouTube. And people would say, what's YouTube? And I'd be like, there's a thing like a URL, go www. And literally people used to be like, what? Nobody understood these terms. So the web series was way ahead of its time.
Mumbai was, I'm trying to think of the chronology here. Mumbai was ahead of like Issa Rae and like.
It was around the same time.
Around the same time-ish.
It was around the same time. But, you know, in studying Issa's story, she was in LA and she came from Stanford. All her people understood that she had something and was a business and they helped her create it. Mumbai was
Indian girl.
No, I was in New York, but nobody got it. Like I had to beg people and I paid money out of my own pocket, like all my savings that I had from MTV and whatever. Like I was spending money to make that show, to actually pay like a camera person, an audio person or whatever. And it's so funny because in season two, we did get an angel investor. Somebody was a fan of the show and gave me, I think it was like $5,000. And I made season one, all of season one on $5,000. And I made season two on like $10,000. And he gave me some money. And I remember he sat me down. And again, these are some of the things I wish creatives understood, or somebody in my family I wish would have helped me understand did this. But he asked me, he's like, so is it like the art or is it a business? And I said, art. And I just didn't understand.
That was the honest answer.
Yeah. And
like, you didn't have a grand plan. You weren't like, well, I'm going to do two seasons on YouTube and then we'll get this many followers. And then I'm going to try and pitch it to the guys at Saturday Night Live and blah, 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 blah. Like it was just, you know, you had to express yourself and you were.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And I did that series for that. Then again, it opened up doors I didn't expect, right? I got my job at MTV because one of their heads of talent saw the series. And then I got a first look deal at Viacom and my job as a digital producer at MTV News. And I was one of their like OG digital producers. And I used to pitch them digital series and influencers and try to teach TV producers, which I used to be, but then I became a digital producer, all this stuff. And they would literally be like, that's so cute. Like our focus is television. And I was like, you guys are like on the wrong track.
You're like, I'm calling you from the future.
Yeah.
I am telling you, this is where it's going.
And it's funny and it's sad, right? Because MTV crashed and it's no longer relevant. And
imagine MTV as a YouTube like creator driven platform. Like, oh my God, right?
Would have been huge. And then it's also funny because, or ironic that now Viacom, you know, shut down basically as a TV channel. It's called Viacom Digital Studios. Like they don't even exist as that anymore. But yeah, like doing something because it was calling to me and then it, you know, it opened up all these doors, but I always wanted it to become something, but I just didn't know how. Like I wanted it to be a TV show, but again, it was so ahead of its time. I've always like fought for South Asian representation. And again, for people who don't know what Mumbai Chopra is, it's basically like she was a materialistic daughter of a spiritual guru. And I said, well, what if Dr. Deepak Chopra had a super materialistic daughter and Paris Hilton was really big at the time? And I said, oh my God, it'd be funny if he had a socialite daughter. And the way Paris Hilton is there, like what if her name is Mumbai Chopra? And she was ditzy, so she wasn't smart like how Indians are portrayed. She was super sexy, but like heart of gold, you know, didn't realize that she was being silly and dumb and sexy and sweet all at the same time. And it came from an improv character. And the reason I'm always proud of it is because the things shows are doing now, we did on that show in 2010. Like Ted Lasso came from an improv character. Mumbai Chopra was an improv character I created for an audition that I couldn't get out of my head. And I was like, oh my God, I just like want to tell all these funny stories about her. And then we would do the way it was shot. We did it where it looked like a mockumentary and she would break the fourth wall and talk to camera and then go back. And Fleabag, like everybody was like, oh my God, this is huge. And I was like, oh, we used to do that on Mumbai Chopra all the time. And then there was this thing where she would vlog to camera first and then we would kind of see it play out. And Last Man Standing did that for like 10 seasons of their show or 11 seasons. So there's so many things that I'm like proud of in that show, including the fact that we had blind casting and, you know, we had Down syndrome actors and trans actors on that show. And
that experience, like that's, I mean, not to tell you what to do, but that's why you never give up on yourself. Like that's why you can't. Just, well, I'm a writer's too hard. I'm not going to do that. Like, and I'm excited to hear that part of the energy that comes out of the strike settlement is that you personally wake up feeling like with a renewed sense of confidence and commitment, right? Because my God, like just go back and listen to this when we publish it next week and listen to those like 11 minutes where you basically just said how far ahead of the curve you were and how many right things you have done and are and did without a big business intention, without any kind of like you just had the pureness of your own intentions and the authenticity of your own creativity, which again is something we talk about with entrepreneurs and founders all the time. Like the whole thesis of this show is like, I always say, like and we say this in our demo reel, like, why do we not tell the stories of, you know, rich, famous, quote unquote, already successful people? Because everybody's already heard those stories. We already know what that story is. Like, the truth is, it's not about the product, or it's about you and like your why. Like, what are you doing? So you said, transition, segue, right? You said you did the same thing that you did with Mumbai Chopra. I did the same thing with my podcast. I didn't really have it. So how did the podcast start? Like, why did you start doing it? And why do you do it now?
So I tend to have this thing of like wanting to explore new mediums when they come out or before they're kind of big. So again, YouTube was this thing, and I was like, oh, well, yeah, the people keep talking about this thing getting big. Let me try it out. And podcasts were becoming very big. Or actually, at the time when we started it, nobody still, again, knew what a podcast was. I started in 2016. And it just was like one of those things where I wanted to have a voice again. I had kind of put acting a little on the back burner for various reasons. And so I wanted a creative outlet. And everybody came to me with their dating stories, or they wanted to talk about dating with me. And I'm so opinionated, and I've always kind of had very strong feelings about these things, but I never felt like I was okay to talk about it. Then I ended up in a relationship. And because I was in like the longest relationship of my adult life at the time, I thought, like, I got this now. I figured it out. And after kind of doing a lot of the work I did, I decided, like, oh, you know what? I think I want to tell people the stuff I wish somebody told me when I was younger. And that was the impetus for kind of dating. And so I was very much like, again, you know, coming back to the business of it all, is that I had to go, because I get asked by people all the time, like, oh, I want to start a podcast. What do I do? Like, what should it be on? And I'm like, firstly, it's got to be a topic that has legs, right? So I knew dating, oh my gosh, there are millions of episodes that we could have on just dating alone. We're at 260 already. So, yeah.
How many years have you been doing this?
Since 2016.
Yeah. So
yeah, almost seven years. Yeah. I mean, we took a 7-month break last year, and that was it. So we did it then. And I'm going like, okay, dating is the topic, but why me? And I had to ask myself that. I said, well, why me? Why would anybody care about what I have to say? And why am I going to make this, like, how am I going to make this stand out? And then a big thing for me is like, I'm a millennial. I don't like being told what to do. So I was like, well, I can't be a hypocrite and tell other people what to do. So this can't be a prescriptive podcast. Okay. And so it turned into like, okay, well, this is going to be an opinion-based podcast. And people would say I'm funny and whatever. I'm opinionated that way. So I was like, so it's got to be like a comedy dating. I didn't want it to be about me because I was like, who am I? So I didn't want it to be, and it's still not about me, but I know from being a host before and being a reporter.
It flows through you.
Yeah.
That's what I say about this. Like, this show isn't about me. It's about you.
Yeah.
Yet I'm a character in it.
Exactly.
Right? So you and I share a space for a period of time, and we're characters in this story. But the truth is, like, if I'm good at what I'm trying to do, it's to amplify your story. Right. Same thing for you. Like, the show is not, it's Natasha's dating show. It's kind of dating with you. And then you also have a co-hostess, right?
Yes, I did have a co-host. Aisha recently has stepped back from co-hosting, and she's chosen to work behind the scenes more. So we actually just talked about it on the podcast. It wasn't me. I didn't kick anybody out. I was like, don't get mad at me. It was her choice. But she's still on the team. But yeah, like, we talked to people from all different points of view. And because I've been a producer, I was able to, you know, come up with a format for the show and little branding things I knew were important, and then get guests and all of that. Yeah. So it's just, and then it just kind of, from there, I didn't know, like, we were at Meltdown Network. They happened to pitch us to Apple. After 4 episodes, Apple loved the podcast, and they featured us in New and Noteworthy. And we were like, what? Oh, okay. And then we just got like a big boom. And from there, it kind of just grew by word of mouth. To this day, I have never put an ad out for kind of dating.
I was just going to say, like, on the business person, Natasha, like,
that's what I'm trying to under, like, I'm, right. This is what I'm telling you. I haven't had those business chops. And now I have friends like you, and I've actually created kind of a mastermind group of people to kind of help me figure out that next step. But Everything has been organic of everything I've ever done. Mumbai Chopra to the podcast, to anything.
Our super creative friend down in Venice Beach, Yogi Roth, calls it your life board. So the mastermind group, he calls it the board of life. He says, so you have a board of directors that are the people, the core group of people. And then he's very specific about it because he's been doing this for years. Is like he rotates, just like you would rotate a corporate board. He rotates members of the life board like every 2 years.
Wow, that's great.
No, like very intentional about it.
And it's been lovely. Like, you know, people like yourself have been so helpful and so taken me under a wing. And that means a lot because I just never had that guidance on the business end. And so now I've taken charge myself and studied a lot and done things. And now I'm like, okay, I think the only, struggle that any entrepreneur has, especially if you're a multi-hyphenate, is that like time and it's only you and how much do you invest money for it to not just be you? So that's kind of the scaling aspect of everything that's hard.
So one of the things you do, which I feel you're going to tell us, I feel like it was maybe more external, like opportunities came to you as opposed to these couple things we've just talked about, which are like literally you gave birth to them, right? So is your emergence as a video game character voiceover star. I mean, like it was like 3 weeks ago and I know nothing about the video game world at all. Like I didn't even game when I was a kid. Like I played like the sports games that were like you could play baseball or basketball, whatever. But the world of gaming that you are like manifesting here, I mean, you're acting. Like that's straight up acting just like anything else. But like 3 weeks ago, we're tweeting about your biggest, latest announcement, which apparently is like one of the biggest games of all time. And we're tweeting with Serena Williams' husband, right? About the fact that he loves that game and you're the character in that game. And he was like, and then he knows me a little bit and he's like, oh, I'll check it out. And I'm like, who is my friend Natasha? Like, what is she doing? So how did all the video game acting, is that what we call it? How did that become a thing in your life?
Yeah, voice acting is something I did when I was in Toronto growing up. Because I used to be a news reporter, I kind of fell into that. I was an actor. I actually used to do a lot of voice work in Toronto. And then when I moved to the States, I just fell off because I don't know, like, you know, my agents in New York were like, you have too much of a Canadian accent. And I was like, oh, really? So I first had to like work on like getting rid of that. And then I just kind of fell out of that. But when I came back here, in LA, I worked for Critical Role and they are huge gaming influencers. So I was a producer for them. But I was like, these guys are huge voice actors, like giant, like the monster level voice actors. And like, I'm going to their houses to film stuff. And I'm like, you guys are fucking rich. I was like, what? How did you do this? And then I was like, they started as voice actors. And I was like, oh, but it wasn't because I wanted to be rich. It just watching them and being in that world again got me so excited. I was like, I love voice acting.
It's just another form of expression.
It is harder than regular acting.
Why so?
Because you have one more layer to express yourself in on-camera acting, which is your face. I can move my face and do stuff. As a voice actor, you have to give the exact emotion in just your voice, whether that's fear, that's anger, that's authority. But those nuances like make such a huge difference. Like voice casting directors can hear the tiniest inflection
like
change.
She smiled.
Yes. A smile.
Like I can hear a smile as opposed to see. So when you're in the studio recording, are you literally like very physical? Because you're a very physical person. Like, are you very physical when you're in the studio to manifest those sounds?
Yep. Like if I'm like when I did Call of Duty, we had to, which was very funny. I was like, wow, I know what I'm going to sound like when I die because we had to do, we had to recreate my death in 30 ways. And so it's like, imagine you're getting run over by a truck. So now you have to like, you have to actually go like, you know, like have to do, or it's like, oh, you're getting choked to death. You're like, you know, you do all of it so that you can actually like do the get the actual voice in. And then if it's a smile, then yeah, you have to smile. So everything's like,
right. Because literally, like, you're in my ear, your tone of voice just changed the minute your mouth widened.
Exactly.
So you can't fake your way through that. Like, you can't be in a shitty mood.
No, because so many people constantly come to me and they're like, I want to be a voice actor. I have a really good voice. And I'm like, that's great. And I think that's an amazing place to start. You have to be able to act. That's the key. And so for me, which I hope your listeners will appreciate this story, is that I did not think I was going to go to be a video game actor. I was in animation, and that's kind of was like my main thing because I do a lot of characters and stuff. But I wanted to expand. So I wrote in a vision board, I want to do video games. And I said, I want to book a video game voiceover. I just thought one, right?
Yeah.
In my vision board, I was like, I don't know, what could represent video game voiceover? And the first game that came to my mind is Call of Duty. I was like, that's like the biggest video game in the world. So I just took an icon of Call of Duty and put it in my vision board and forgot about it. And then when you book these voiceover things, especially in video games, they have project code names. So you don't actually know what you booked.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah. Okay. So I booked something and I was like, oh, cool. Wow. I booked a video game. Like, it actually happened. Great. And then I went to the session, and when the session started, all these people come up on screen and they go, welcome to Call of Duty. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I had no idea that that's, so all the games that I've booked, I have no idea what they are. And that's where.
Until they are.
And then the only one I kind of knew was Ghostbusters because it said Ghostbusters 16. Like, so I was like, okay, I guess I'm going for a Ghostbuster.
All right. So I don't even know if this is possible, but for our listeners, let's literally like list out. So what are the games?
I mean, I am still like, I'm not.
You're on these things for life, right?
Yeah, it's like, yeah. I'm not Critical Role level. That's like my goal and dream, but I'm very fortunate to have been in some of the biggest franchises to start. Okay. So Call of Duty Vanguard is one, the first big one.
What character are you?
Padmavati Balan, who's the very first Indian female character in franchise history. For Call of Duty, that was really big. Rogue Company is a very popular cult game. And I play Kestrel in that, who's also the first Indian female. Ghostbusters, Spirits Unleashed, also the first Indian female. Then this year I got very lucky. Starfield, which is the big one.
That was the one.
Again, you have no idea. You just like, well, there's
the funny
like,
part is it was like all over my social media feeds that day. Regardless, like just everything was about Starfield. And then all of a sudden, like you popped up into my feed one moment and I was like, wait, she's talking about Starfield too. And then I start reading it and I'm like, oh my God, she's in this thing that the rest of the world was talking about today.
Yeah. So Starfield is a big one. And then, that one's not Indian character. So that's Riley. She's just, you have to talk to her to enter.
Ironically, my daughter's name, which is spelled differently.
Yeah, I know. Right.
Right?
Yeah. And then two others, which is Fallout 76. And that's Vera Thornburg in that, and Valorant, which I haven't announced, which I was going to announce actually tomorrow, because there might be a video game strike. So I was like, ooh, I should just mention this. So I've been very lucky that they happen to just be some of the biggest games in the world. And a couple of the jobs, like Valorant and Fallout, I actually got without auditioning, which I was so grateful and humbled by.
Relationships? Just people that knew you?
No, I just, the people at Starfield liked my work. And I think Fallout 76 is a Bethesda game. And they were like, hey, we liked her in that. We want to put her in Fallout. But it was a Southern character in Fallout, so like they didn't even know I could do that, but they were like, here you go. I was like, I love it.
They've never seen your Nikki Haley, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. Now they have.
Now the world has. And tonight the world will see Nikki Haley actually doing her best impression of you doing an impression of her.
I know, it's true. I'm gonna post a new Nikki Haley video tomorrow, actually. And then Valorant, same thing. Riot Games heard that one. They heard about me and they just reached out to my agents and were like, hey, we've heard she does great work, we'd like her.
That's awesome. And I mean, like, so many enduring lessons that, again, just are so applicable. If we haven't made our point yet, like, it's this: if you're entrepreneurs, you are creators ultimately. At the end of the day, you're creators of your businesses, your products, your own brand. And you have to have, as a founder, as a startup founder or CEO nowadays, you have to develop your own social media presence. You have to develop your own brand. And entertainers, like, you're business people. You are entrepreneurs. And your whole current and future worth and value is not personal worth, emotional worth, but like financial worth is tied up in the intellectual property that is uniquely gifted to your brain and your heart and your body, right? So be sensible about that. Like, seek smart people around you. Don't be shy about what you don't know. Ask for help, learn new things. Like, put yourself in the company of people who can help you achieve the things you want to achieve. And I used to say this about our consulting business, was that it was, I really enjoyed doing it, but it wasn't like the thing, but it was the thing upon which we could stand to do all the things that we wanted to do our way, right? And so in some ways, that's what you've done. Like, you've built, and eventually it'll be Natasha Productions, right? An LLC. But like, you've essentially built that virtually already anyways. And then you stand upon that, which is this is how I see the world. This is my point of view. This is what I bring uniquely that no other 8 billion people on the planet bring. And I want to use this to do a lot of different things. Same for entrepreneurs, right? Like, you know, nobody builds one, and sadly, it's the stories we always hear about. You know, yeah, Zuckerberg built one product. That's all he's ever going to do his entire life. But that's also kind of sad, because Zuckerberg is probably talented and bright enough to have done 27 different things in his life that could have been impactful. So entrepreneurs and entertainers, we're all in the same boat. But I have a question for you. I have a question for you, because we just listed like a whole litany of things that you do. What is something in the creative space or in the entertainment world that you haven't done yet that you are like, on the vision board now, I want to do this?
Now it's just, I'm at the point where I'm like, all right, I'm just ready to sell my show and be a showrunner. Like, that's where I'm at. I'm not.
So the vision board is kind of like the refresh, like, I've always had this goal. Now I'm going to make it a bigger logo and put it in the middle of the vision board instead of it. But here, it was over here on the side for a handful of years.
Yeah. I think I'm just at that point where it's like, I've done everything I've wanted to do, I think, in the industry in terms of that, except being a showrunner and having my own hit show. I keep saying, I'm like, I don't want just a regular show.
No, like, come on. Who wants to do regular shows?
I'm like,
right?
let's claim that. I'm not going to.
Yes, exactly. Like, we want to create big, huge success stories. And quick glossary of terms, showrunner, which we've used a whole bunch of times, is the person who creatively, but also the kind of operationally, business-wise, oversees the production of a television show. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're, you know, in simplest terms, they're like the head writer, but they usually also created the show itself, and usually they wrote the pilot. And so they have the creative vision for the show, and they are the person that every department goes to go like, creatively, how do you want this? What color would this character wear? Whatever, because they imagined this idea in the first place. So they are the creative head of the show.
The entrepreneurial equivalency is the founder, right?
Exactly.
In that sense, yeah.
The visionary, yeah.
Although sometimes in your industry, showrunners who were the original founder, just like happens in the entrepreneurial world, leave that show or company for some reason. And then like the guy who was the vice president or the senior writer gets potentially invited by the funding company or studio to take over as that, right?
That's
so they're not always, the showrunners aren't always the original writer of the thing. Sometimes they inherit a show that they might've written on, or they take over someone else's idea, so to speak.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, Dan Harmon in Community is a very public example. He was the showrunner and creator of Community. And then partway through, he left. And so they brought on a couple other showrunners, I think, in the meantime, and it didn't work out with them. And then Dan Harmon came back.
Ah, interesting. Which is like the Steve Jobs Apple story. Like,
yeah,
literally,
exactly.
It was Jobs gives birth to Apple, leaves, and then the glorious return, which created a whole movie.
Yep. So yeah, there's lots of parallels in that.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. We could literally spend the rest of the day talking, but I'm sure you have 27 other hyphenated things to go do. So we're going to turn you into the mentor for the day. So three pieces of advice, wisdom, guidance, and it could be to anybody in the context of what we're talking about. I don't care. I just want you to have a platform to share three pieces of wisdom based on your life experiences.
A lot of people ask me how I've done so much stuff, what drives me, what motivates me, blah, 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 all these things. And I always feel like reflectively, I'm like, what were those things that got me to where I am? And it's two part for me, and I hope that it resonates with some people. One is intuition and gut. Anything I've done, I knew when I was very young that I wanted, I actually used to say this. I said that I wanted to have an empire. And I said, I want to know every person's job, because I didn't want to have anybody like do a one over on me. I wanted to know every part of my business because I was obsessed with it. And as a result, I made a lot of choices, which was very yes-anding life. I yes-anded and I said yes to everything. And so this is why I have done so much, where people are like, how many lives have you lived? I'm like, because I worked since I was like 15, but I also did everything. The stuff you don't know, guys. I used to be a publicist. I used to be a dance teacher for years. I have done PR marketing. I've done so many things.
But you followed your gut. You followed your intuition.
Yeah, and it was always gut. And I learned very young that life is short. I used to be very sick. And so when I was 21, they told me I might have a rare brain disease that had no cure. And I was like, oh, whoa. And, you know, I'd already been kind of sick for some time now at that point. And I was like, oh, that was the first time I had a breakdown. And I was like, uh-oh, like, I think that's it. And when they told me it wasn't and that I was fine and that I didn't have a rare brain disease, they didn't know what was wrong with me still. Turned out to be Lyme disease. But they were like, it's not this rare brain disease. I just left home. And I just was like, you know what? I had always wanted to go to New York and work for MTV. And I told my parents, I was like, I'm leaving. And, you know, Indian parents, conservative immigrants, like, it's not a thing that happens. But something in my gut was like, go. And I left in a month.
Took your 27 Canadian dollars in your bank.
Yeah, yeah. Literally, I whatever money I had saved from working odd jobs since I was like 15 is what I went with. I had no job. I had no visa. I went on a $50 megabus with two bags of clothes. I did not have a place to stay. I called a friend right before I went and I was like, can I crash on your couch for 2 weeks? And it turned into a month and a half. And I figured my life out. But the other part is when I was on the bus, there was a sign that said, life is beautiful, experience it. And I was like, whoa. And that has always been it's a sense of like, I always try to remember it even with all the noise that happens.
Sure.
and all the garbage, and you're always going to go through ups and downs. But I always remember like, life is beautiful, experience it, which means like you have to do stuff to experience life. So oftentimes, very recently with the strike, I've thought a lot and reflected a lot and been like, what if this is the end? What if I died? And honestly, I was like, I did a lot. So like, I'm okay because I did a lot. And
all the crazy aunties right now are knocking on wood. Like, we don't want that to happen to you.
No, no, same. But like that experience it part, you know, I'm like, I really have experienced life. I've experienced highs.
You've lived fully.
Yeah. And I've experienced super low.
Because for context, everybody, we don't talk about people's ages, but she's still very young. She has a lifetime in front of her still.
But I've just done a lot of things since I was young. And so like, you know, whatever. And then, okay, here's one just very clear piece of advice. You said three. I feel like I already gave eight in the first one.
This is like three, A, B, C, D, E, and F.
Yeah, yeah. this one is just figure out what purpose is driving you. Because when anything goes, shit hits the fan, the only thing that will pull you out and help you put one foot in front of the other for your business is purpose. You have to know your why. And hopefully it's a deeper why than just you wanting to be famous. But like, if that's also it, great.
Yeah, because important to admit that, whether that's enough to carry you forward or not is another discussion. But like, at least be honest with yourself, right?
100%. And for me, it was always, I love to make people smile and change their mood And it's very important to me to leave the world a little bit better than I saw it. And that's what drives me whenever I do feel multiple times. I'm like, I'm just done. I'm done with this business. I want to get out. What's wrong with me? Just go get a regular job like regular people do. And then I'm like, but I want to help in my own way. And then the last thing is like work ethic. I'm a huge person on having really strong work ethic. I just don't think that we enforce that a lot with people. Again, when everybody's like, how come you're so good at A, B, C, D, E, like in each one of these things? I'm like, because I work really hard. And when I say that, I mean like I take classes, I pay money to get demo reels, I invest in myself and the business. Like if when I started podcasting, I learned about podcasting, I do anything, I study it, and then I go and
you take yourself seriously in that sense. Yeah. And then to your point before, right? Like life is beautiful, experience it. So work hard is that third bit of advice. And the bit of that you've already exhibited is just put stuff out there. Like if you're a creator, if you're a storyteller, if you're like, tell a story, post something, write something, write anything. I mean, like we joked about this when I met, and I still have like kind of laugh at myself about it sometimes, but now I'm appreciating it more. Like my little Rob story, which started on social media as like a self therapy exercise to hold myself accountable to something I was trying to do way back in 2016. And now it's literally, I've written 2,831 of those things in a row.
Wow.
Like I've written 2,831 150 to 250 word stories a day for 7.5 years.
That's amazing. You could probably make that into a little book.
Right? So at some point, it's just like, whatever it is that you're feeling, just put it out there. Like that, like, it's like, put the work in. Make the effort. Like, because if you sit back, it's not enough. Like, you got to put it out there. That's awesome.
Yeah, because everybody has an idea, right? But like, the only people who succeed are the ones who like put in the effort. Because again, I just get hit up by so many people. And they're always like, I want to do this, and I want to do this, and I want to do this. I'm like, cool, cool, cool. You can do anything. I truly believe people can do anything. I'm like, you just got to put in some work. It's just not going to happen without it.
We say it in the entrepreneurial world all the time, right? Ideas are a dime a dozen. It's the execution that wins.
Yep.
Right. So that's what you just said. So this is a blast, buddy. Thank you.
This is great.
This is a different unconventional way to have a conversation amongst friends from Hollywood to wherever you live in the South Bay.
I love it. I've been so grateful to have met you on socials, and you've become such a great friend and supporter, and like just like a wonderful bundle of energy and positive energy, which means
I'm a big bundle. You're a small bundle. I'm a big bundle.
You're not that big, but yeah, like you've just been such a positive force. So I've really appreciated that.
It's a great conversation. How do people find you amidst all these things? How do we find you on social? Where should we go check it out? So if you live in LA or Southern California, you can go find her, see her at stand-up comedy clubs. But where do we find you on social media or connect with you?
Yeah, you can go to natashachandel.com, and that has kind of everything there. Or on Instagram, I always joke that I'm everybody's complicated friend because people stole all my handles, so I have different ones for everything. It's at Natasha Chandel on Instagram, at natasha.chandel on TikTok, natasha_chandel on Twitter.
There we go. And of course, Kind of Dating, the podcast, which we talked about before. It just showed up this week, I think, in Good Pod's top 50 list of podcasts. Obviously, it's available on all the podcasting platforms, wherever you get your podcasts, but go listen to it. It's awesome. You're awesome. Grateful for you. You are truly a creative just force of energy. I'm excited mostly just to hear that you're excited again post-strike. And yeah. I can't wait to watch what both you and in parallel, my daughter, I can't wait to watch the moves you guys make in this coming year because both of you have the same shared ambition, which is fundamentally to tell the stories of people whose stories don't get told often enough. And aren't represented enough. And fuck it if that isn't what the whole world needs so that we can have it be a little bit better place when we leave. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Ron.
As always, we thank you so much for listening. Today's show was recorded in Los Angeles and produced by Deanna Bernal in Mexico City. You can always find, like, follow, subscribe, and share our show via any popular podcasting platform, as well as find us on social media at Mentors Today. And if you'd like to connect with our host, you can find Rob at I Am Rob Ryan on just about any social media platform. Gracias, and thank you.